Welcome to the Hurricane Center podcast, produced by the Storm Science Network and part of the National Tropical Weather Conference. This podcast is made possible by USAA, the South Padre Island Convention and Tourist Bureau, and Plylox Hurricane Clips.
This morning, we have the privilege of having a colleague that I got to know pretty well when I was working at the Hurricane Center, Jim Cossin, who is based out of Wisconsin. But I found out this morning he, as of May, he had retired from his NOAA position and now has a collection of interesting jobs, one still with the University of Wisconsin there in Madison, and a new job, a position as senior scientist with the Climate Service out of Raleigh, North Carolina. The recent work that Jim's done is really focused on trends that we're seeing in tropical cyclones and what that may have to do with climate change. I believe that's what he's going to be talking about. So, Jim, without further ado, it's all yours.
All right. Thanks so much, Bill, and Tim and Alex as well. Certainly being here is an honor and a privilege, and I'm just thrilled to be able to present some of this material to everyone out there, and hopefully we'll get some interesting discussions along the way. The title, I tried to keep it as generic as possible, Tropical Cyclones and Climate Change. This could have a comma, what we know and what we don't know. And that's mostly what I'll be talking about today, is some of the evidence that we have and some of the uncertainties that go along with it. So I think it's always best to start with some basic physical understanding. Otherwise, we're just sort of when we start getting into the data and looking for trends, we're just on a fishing expedition. There ought to be some reason why we would expect a trend. And so I thought I would start here with our basic physical understanding of how tropical cyclone intensity might respond to climate change. And we have a pretty well-established framework here that was introduced 40 years ago, or maybe a little less than that, but close to 40 years ago by Kerry Emanuel at MIT. And that is this idea that the atmosphere at any given time, if you were to just drop a tropical cyclone down into it, the atmosphere sets a limit on how strong that tropical cyclone could get as long as everything else is optimal. So no shear and no upwelling, everything is just perfect for it. So this is what we might call a thermodynamic speed limit. And again, the best way to think about it, I think, is just at any given point, pick a point on the planet over ocean in the tropics, preferably drop a hurricane down in it. The potential intensity tells you how strong it can get. So we have that, and we do have a pretty solid understanding of the physics behind that. Now, what the potential intensity depends on are two primary factors. One is the ocean surface temperature, and also the heat content, because the ocean does get stirred up when you have a strong hurricane sitting over it, but also the temperature and the moisture state of the atmosphere. So those are the two main things. And we know pretty much what greenhouse gas concentrations or increasing greenhouse gas concentrations does to these two things. And so it does, in fact, increase the potential intensity. So if you think about it, we have all these different intensities that a tropical cyclone can achieve. And now we're pushing the outer limit out further and further. And what happens here, and this is fairly ubiquitous across, there's sort of a right way and a wrong way to think about some of these trends that we see and some of these changes that we talk about. And I think that the mantra here is that a small change in the average quite often translates to a very large change in the extremes. And this will come up time and time again. This is true for a global temperature and the occurrence of heat waves, things like that. So this is a sort of a hypothetical situation here where we have this sort of distribution of all the possible wind speeds and knots between 35 knots and about 170 or so. And the blue curve here is basically just hypothetically what was happening, let's say, in the early part of this long period of data that we may have. And then the later period is described by this red line, and this is sort of the probability. So your maximum probability is somewhere around hurricane strength. And in between the early and later period, it only changes by just a few knots. So if somebody says, oh, it just changes the average by a little bit, what's the big deal? Well, okay, but that's the wrong thing to be concentrating on. Because it's not these storms that are the most dangerous. It's these storms out here, these major category 3, 4, 5. When you shift potential intensity a little bit to the right, it's very easy to increase the probability of exceeding category 5 intensity quite a lot. In this case, it more than doubles. In fact, it almost triples. And the way to think about that is it's an exceedingly rare event, right, to have category 5 intensity. But it's three times more likely with this increase of potential intensity. So if you take away anything from this talk, that would be one of them, is that small changes in the mean generally translate to large proportional changes on the extreme ends. And it's the extreme ends that we really care about in terms of mortality and damage. Okay, so this is some work that that was done recently where during the satellite era, a globally homogenized data set for intensity was developed. We all know that the best track data, particularly the global best track data, has lots of flaws and inconsistencies in it. So this is a fixed up data set where most of those inconsistencies are removed. And then we look to see if there was any sort of change in the proportion of major hurricane fixes. And I'm not sure if everyone here knows what a fix is, but it's a 6-hourly estimate of location and intensity and some other metrics. But here we're just looking at intensity. So if we look globally, we can see that there is a trend upwards, and it is statistically significant, and it describes a change of about 25% over the last 4 decades. In other words, if you have a hurricane out there or a tropical cyclone at hurricane strength, and the likelihood of it being at major hurricane intensity is now 25% more likely than it was 40 years ago. Now, we're not necessarily saying why this is, right? That this is, we're not attributing this to anything, but it certainly looks suspicious when we find a trend like that in a global sense. Now, in the North Atlantic, and this would probably come as no surprise to many people, this trend is much steeper. The y-axis scale here is quite a bit larger than the one over here. This is actually more than doubled, the proportion in the North Atlantic since around 1979. Now, the Atlantic is contributing quite a lot to the global trend, but even if you remove the Atlantic data, you still have a positive trend towards increased likelihood of having major tropical cyclone intensity, category 3, 4, or 5. And again, these are the storms that really matter in terms of risk. The other thing, another piece of work that came out in the last it was found that the intensification rates of tropical cyclones was changing, and rapid intensification events were becoming more likely. So in this case, 40 years ago, the chance of having an intensification event of 35 miles per hour or more in a 24-hour period was about 1 in 100. 30 years later, the chance had increased by a factor of 5 to 1 over 20. And this is some work that folks at GFDL and Princeton were responsible for. So from a forecasting point of view, of course, this is presents a great challenge, because there's nothing more frightening than rapid intensification, particularly near landfall. It's difficult to forecast, and it it creates so much more risk, and there's not enough time to for emergency managers to respond to it. So people sheltering in place may suddenly find themselves in an unexpected situation. Okay, the other thing that we have a really good understanding of is the amount of rain that falls out of tropical cyclones. This is, again, very, very basic thermodynamic physics. And we know that if you warm the atmosphere, you increase the amount of water vapor it can hold. We know it's about 7% more per degree C of warming. And we also, it would be too hard to convince you that tropical cyclones are pretty good at turning water vapor into rain. So we have a pretty good level of confidence that tropical cyclones are raining harder now that the atmosphere has warmed. This is difficult to measure for many reasons. Certainly globally, our precipitation record, especially rain gauges, is sketchy at best, and even here in the United States, where the data are generally considered comparatively quite good, it still has warts on it. And one particularly unfortunate problem with rain gauge data is that it tends to be less accurate in high wind environments. So clearly, that's problematic for tropical cyclone measuring tropical cyclone rainfall. But this is something that we have pretty good confidence in, that more rain is falling out of these systems globally. Here's where we really start to struggle. We really have a lot of trouble figuring out how tropical cyclogenesis or tropical storm formation responds to climate change. We know that greenhouse gas warming warms the ocean because the ocean equilibrates with the air above it. And this by itself certainly is going to increase formation rates. But greenhouse gas warming also tends to stabilize the atmosphere a little bit and dry out the middle layers. And this suppresses formation. And so there's a tug of war going on here. One of the elements of greenhouse gas concentrations is to warm the ocean and increase formation. But the other one is to stabilize the atmosphere and dry it and suppress formation. So this creates a situation where our confidence is lower on this, but the general consensus is that greenhouse gas warming by itself does not increase tropical cyclone frequency. We don't expect to see more storms forming. So this is a key thing, and it's somewhat constrained, and it's a shame that we can't get a better handle on formation and how it responds to warming. But what we can say is that when a tropical cyclone exists, so we're taking formation out of the picture, when it exists, it's more likely to be at major intensity. It's more likely to rapidly intensify. It's more likely to have greater rainfall rates, but there may not be more of them. And this is really problematic because when we want to really assess changes in risk, we need that information. Right. I mean, a return period, which is how many years between category 4 landfalls. Well, you need the absolute frequency, not just the relative frequency. So this is a limiting factor in our ability to project and forecast future tropical cyclone risk. And it's an active area of research. OK, this is what I call a not so subtle subtlety. This really creates lots of confusion and challenges for us when we try to understand how tropical cyclones respond to climate change, because the ocean warming that occurs through increased globally well-mixed greenhouse gas, right? So CO2 is kind of well-mixed all around the planet, and the warming is, you know, there's patterns to it, but it's fairly uniform globally in the tropics particularly. Now, how does that compare to regional warming by other factors other than greenhouse gases? Well, what would those be? Well, in the Atlantic, we have things like the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, sometimes called a thermohaline circulation, sometimes called part of the Great Ocean Conveyor Belt. But the idea here is that this is ocean circulation that does exhibit variability, and it does create regional differences in ocean temperature. Okay, so that's one that's internal to the system and natural. We also have things that are external to the system, which means radiatively forced. So it has to do with incoming short wave from the sun, outgoing long wave from the warmth that it creates. And this external can be natural as well. So Saharan dust concentration has different variability, not just on a year to year, but also decade to decade. Volcanic eruptions, you could have a dearth of them, you could have a lot of them. That's completely natural. And it also affects the regional ocean temperature. And then finally, there's an external anthropogenic. And of course, the greenhouse gas is external anthropogenic, but we're looking at regional forcing now. So what we find in the Atlantic is the concentration of sulfate aerosol pollution has undergone some fairly dramatic swings over the past 100 years. And the reason for that, let me check my time here. Okay. The reason for that is that during the Industrial Revolution, we were putting a lot of aerosol pollution into the air. And for any of you who were around in the 60s and the 70s, you can, especially in urban environments, you might remember just how bad it was. I can say that as a New Yorker, it was difficult to see across the Hudson River to New Jersey back in those days. And then the Clean Air Act and amendments came along, and they were very effective and have been very effective at cleaning up the air. But what that did is the greenhouse gas concentrations are steadily increasing in sort of a linear way, making things warmer and warmer. But then there's this offsetting thing where we're adding more and more pollution into the air. It's blocking more and more sunlight from reaching the ocean surface, which has a cooling effect. And so you have this sort of offsetting effect to the greenhouse gas warming. Now you start to remove this aerosol pollution, and now both of them, now you're removing it, and that has a warming effect that adds to the warming effect of the greenhouse gases. And what you're left with is what we have been experiencing in the Atlantic since about the mid-90s. Now, this is still not absolutely for certain. There's still some discussion and debate in the literature about how much of what I just described is dominating what we're seeing versus how much of this ocean circulation variability is dominating it. But the evidence continues to build that the ocean variability is playing a lesser role. And most of what we're seeing in the Atlantic since the mid-90s is due to a combination of increasing greenhouse gases and decreasing sulfate aerosol pollution. And I'm always a little bit remiss to say that because I don't want people to say, well, then the answer to, you know, getting things to be quiescent in the Atlantic again is to pollute more. Clearly, that's not a good way forward. You know, we need to be able to keep the air breathable and clean, but we are now sort of paying the price for the quiescence of the 70s and the 80s in the Atlantic that seems to be partly or not at least largely due to this aerosol pollution that was out there. Okay, so we've been talking about intensity, frequency, rain rates. Track changes are also really important. And you can imagine that if you start seeing more and more Category 5 storms, but none of them ever make landfall, then the risk landscape is actually becoming more benign. And this is a good thing. So you really can't leave track changes out of the discussion. And in fact, they could affect the risk landscape even more than the changes in intensity or frequency and or any of these other things, because you suddenly find these tropical cyclones threatening areas that are maybe not quite so used to being threatened by them, and that might mean that they're a little bit less prepared. Also, they could start ending up in much more populated areas in the middle latitudes. And that seems to be what's happening. There's a global signal where in some regions and most regions, actually, there seems to be a general poleward migration of where tropical cyclones are reaching their peak lifetime intensity. So wherever their maximum or peak intensity achieved during their lifetime, it's occurring at higher and higher latitudes in both the southern and the northern hemispheres. This is particularly pronounced in the Western North Pacific. So I just want to show that. And this circles back to that important point we talked about earlier about a small change in the mean quite often translates to a very large change in the extremes. And so here is a distribution of the latitude where tropical cyclones in the Western North Pacific reach their peak intensity. And the red is the early period and the blue is the late period. These are not hypothetical. These are from actual data. And what we see is that between the early and late stages, the average latitude of peak intensity just shifts a few degrees, couple degrees, hardly anything. It's over there around where Taiwan would be. They're sort of right at the cusp. If we look back here toward the equator, deeper into the tropics, we can see that the exposure actually does decrease a little bit as these storms shift away. They're no longer reaching their peak intensity down here. That's good news for the Philippines. But when we look over here at the higher latitudes where these storms are migrating to, you see these huge increases in exposure. So the probability of having a storm reach peak intensity at, say, 35 degrees, around where you'd find Japan, Korea, and northeastern China, will more than double. Again, it's a very rare event, but proportionally, it's twice as likely now as it used to be. So these are where the signals reside, and this is generally true of climate change. The signals often reside in the extreme ends of these distributions. And a good way to think about it, again, is heat waves, right? We have global warming, and people say, okay, the Earth has warmed up 1 degree C in the last 100 years. And people go, well, what do I care about 1 degree C? I mean, if I go outside and it's 89 Fahrenheit versus 87 Fahrenheit, what do I care? But what happens with these things is that the likelihood of heat waves goes up enormously. And these are the events that are the most dangerous and risky. So again, it's a kind of a mantra that needs to be established that you don't think about this in terms of how the averages are changing. Think about how that affects the extremes. The other thing that seems to be happening as far as tropical cyclone tracks is that they seem to be moving more slowly over land than they used to be, and they seem to be stalling more often. So this is just a quick global look. All these little black dots are the 6-hourly fixes in the global best track data, I think since the... Well, I'm not sure. I think since the 80s, I forget now what this is from, but some fairly good long period of time. And there's about a 16% slowdown of these storms here over the United States and Mexico and in the Caribbean, and even over here for the Eastern North Pacific and the Eastern North Pacific hurricanes out here. We have about a 3% slowdown here in the area of Mozambique, Madagascar. We have about a 22% slowdown over Australia and about a 21% slowdown over land here along the Southeast Asian. So what's going on there? Well, let's just focus on the continental United States for a moment. And a good motivation for doing that is that that's where the best data are. And also the landfall record for the Atlantic is considered to be pretty reliable all the way back to 1900. So let's take advantage of that greater confidence in our data and go back as far as we can. So now we're going back 120 years. And let's look at all the different fixes we have over the continental U.S. There's 3,651 of them. And then let's see how their movement, their translation speed, the speed from which they move from one point to the other across land. Let's see how that's changing. And that's shown here. These little black dots show all the different speeds between all these red dots over here, how fast these are moving. And you can see there's some really fast movers. And these, of course, are probably going to be the ones over here that are caught up in the mid-latitude westerlies and just flying toward the east. But then you also have, you know, a greater concentration of these are, you know, down here. And the median, which is close to the average, is here at around 23 kilometers per hour. That's your average speed of motion for these storms over land over the United States. This median speed has decreased, and it is statistically significant, by 14% over 120 years. The slowest storms, this is the slowest 10% of all these storms. Again, slow in terms of how quickly they're moving forward, not how fast they're spinning. Slowest of these is slowed down by 24%. That's a lot. That's a really, really big difference. Now, what does that mean? Well, what that means is that we're going to see a lot more local rainfall and much more freshwater flooding, because there's two things that local rainfall depend on. One is the rain rate, which is the rate at which rain is falling out of these tropical cyclones. And then it also depends on how quickly it's moving. So if we say that we've had about 1 degree C of warming since 1900, and that should increase the rain rate by about 7%, as we saw earlier, and then the slowest storms are now 25% slower, when we look at how much change in local rainfall that gives us, it's a fairly large number. I might even say it's a whopping number, 41%. This is certainly somewhat alarming. And there is a, you know, we're attempting to get a better handle on what could be behind this. The most basic physical argument for this slowing down of forward translation speed in these subtropics and middle latitudes would be due to something called Arctic amplification. And this is a well-known phenomenon where the poles are warming more quickly than the tropics. And that means that the temperature difference between the poles and the tropics is decreasing. And that means that the pressure difference between the poles and the tropic is decreasing. And it's the pressure difference that drives the westerlies. And so at Arctic amplification in its simplest form should slow down the westerlies. And most of these storms are in the westerlies at these latitudes. So that's a plausible physical explanation for what we're seeing and how it might be linked to climate change. But this is still pretty new, and a lot more work needs to be done, particularly with models, to see how easy it is to reproduce these signals. One of the problems is that when you slow storms down, they're more likely to stall. And that's where we really get into trouble. That's when things really get devastating. And you can imagine that a storm that's just barreling along at 30 kilometers per hour, it's pretty unlikely to just suddenly stop and sit in one place for a while. But storms that are moving more slowly are much more slaved to the nuances of the environment that they're in, much more likely to slow down, much more likely to experience a stall, or even a complete reversal, as we saw in Hurricane Harvey. And some work that Tim Hall did from NASA showing that the likelihood or the frequency of stalled systems has increased substantially since 1944 over the United States. So this goes along, this is consistent with that slowdown that we were just looking at. And we've been seeing quite a few recent examples of these stalled systems. We had three last year, Iota, Eta, and Sally. Dorian, just awful disaster for the Bahamas in 2019, just sat there. In addition to the amount of rain that falls out of these stalled systems, the amount of damage done by the wind is not just a function of wind speed, it's also a function of wind event duration. So if you leave a storm in one place for a long time, it's very likely to just flatten everything. Florence was another example. Harvey was another example. Cyclone Idai that hit Mozambique was another example, just, you know, in case we don't. This is not just happening in the Atlantic. So these are some of the signals that we've been seeing. So we've seen intensity. We've seen rain rate. We talked about frequency. We talked about intensification rate. We talked about track changes in terms of there seems to be a general migration out of the tropics that's exposing places at higher latitudes. And we seem to be seeing more likely slow movers and stalled systems. And I will stop there. I think I'm at 30 minutes almost exactly. So that worked out well. And I am very much looking forward to discussion. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, just end the share. And my guy here, Tim or Alex, says a sponsor mention from one of you guys. So turn it over to you for a minute. Great. Yeah, if I can only read my writing, I'd get the questions right. early on, you were talking about the increased likelihood of the categories 3, 4, and 5 being higher. The increase was higher for the North Atlantic than the other basins. Why is that so?
Yeah, wonderful. So is it okay for me to show slides as we answer questions, or is that going to mess things up?
Nope, it'll work.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's a terrific question. And this gets back to what we were talking about here. The Atlantic has quite a lot of regional warming through all of these factors that we have listed here. And the Atlantic, in a sense, it sort of beats to its own drum. It has a decadal and multi-decadal variability to it that is somewhat unique to that particular region. And what I didn't get into in any detail in this talk is that the way that hurricanes respond to warming through greenhouse gas warming is much smaller than the way that they respond to these regional warming events. And so this combination of these three regional warming factors here have created a situation where the tropical cyclones in the Atlantic are responding much, much more strongly than we see anywhere else.
Is it fairly recent, the definitive studies on the effect of the sulfate aerosols on perhaps leading to a fairly long period of reduced activity in the Atlantic before we cleaned up the air?
I would not use the word definitive. I would use the word the evidence continues to mount that is the major player in what we have observed. So if we just look at the ocean temperature since 1900 in the Atlantic, and we see that sort of, it ramps up, drops way down again, ramps back up again. That quiescent period in the 70s and 80s, there was an active period in the 40s, 50s, into the 60s, then got active again from the mid-90s to where we are now. That variability, that slow decadal variability, is mostly due to the combination of greenhouse gases, sulfate aerosols. Saharan dust plays a role. There's papers that have quantified that. And also volcanic eruptions, and with a smaller contribution from ocean variability. Yeah, and that's just kind of where the literature is right now.
Okay, yeah, because that's something I've just really become familiar with since I retired. I'm sure there was work out there, but it hadn't gotten on my radar screen. It's fascinating. I was really interested in your point about the influences of the climate change hitting on the extremes and not the averages, and that's a very good. I'm very glad to see that slide. I'll be stealing that when I'm talking about rainfall problems down here over the future. The study you did on the heavier rain and the slowdowns. The slide said hurricanes, but did you include tropical storms also?
Yes, that was all named storms.
Yeah, because more than half of the 20-inch or greater type rainfalls we've had in Texas from landfalling storms have been systems that were never hurricanes.
No, absolutely. And in fact, if the position data is in the best track, if those fixes are there, regardless of what the intensity is, it's included in that. It's included here. Yes. So as long as they're still being tracked by NHC, they're in there.
Yeah, we already have. I think the mean speed in the of all storms making landfall on the Texas coast is slightly below 10 knots. So That's already a signal for pretty good rainfall. So a 24% slowdown would be even more radical. It's the looking into the future, the decrease in the temperature difference between the poles and the tropics. Is that going to continue that way, or does it reach a point of leveling out?
That's a great question, and I'm sure that would make a really good project for someone to look into. I mean, we're never going to reach a place where the poles and the tropics are the same temperature. And just because this incoming shortwave is more in the tropics, and you always need to have heat transport from the tropics to the poles happening through these large circulation patterns. I guess I couldn't say where that limit is. Unfortunately, when it comes to warming of the Arctic and Antarctic, it's not necessarily very linear, because you have these tipping points and you have these feedback mechanisms, right? So that the snow gets dirty and it becomes browner, and then it absorbs even more sunlight, melts even faster. When it goes away completely, you lose all the reflectivity of the ice, and things happen really quickly. So it's kind of spooky to think about. But I think that we would expect certainly to see this continue for the next 30 years.
That's kind of where I was thinking on that. With the heavy rain producers that I've looked at down here in the central western Gulf Coast, almost invariably the stalling pattern is fairly significant. Some tropical highs both to the west and east of the area here. Would the slowing down of the westerlies encourage more development of that pattern, do you think?
I would think so, for the same reason that, you know, when you have a really, really strong jet stream, it has a tendency to be less wavy. And I don't know if Michael Mann, when he spoke with you folks in the past, touched on that, but that's also still somewhat controversial, but a pretty hot topic, and that is how the Arctic amplification is affecting the waviness of the jet and creating these blocking highs. So it's not just slowing down tropical cyclones, it's also increasing the chances of getting these stalled rain events like we have been seeing this year, and these heat waves that are, you know, these omega blocking highs where the air just sits there and bakes. So I guess the short answer is that, yeah, I think there's a fair amount of evidence to suggest that this slowdown is going to have effects on some of these stationary wave patterns that you're talking about.
I guess the migrating higher latitudes of the intensity is a strong function of the potential intensity, given the warming of both the ocean and the atmosphere.
Yes, that's right. In fact, what we found is that as the tropics expand, and by the way, there's a whole lot of people who that's all they study is tropical expansion, right? And there's enormous amount of independent research talking about that has nothing to do with tropical cyclones. And it does kind of make sense that if you expand the tropics, you're going to expand the realm of the tropical cyclones. But in addition to the environment becoming more benign at higher latitudes for tropical cyclones, there also is some signs that it becomes a little bit more hostile near the equator at the same time. So those two things acting together are sort of driving them, you know, out of one neighborhood and into another, basically.
Yeah, the hostility being the warmer and drier mid-level atmosphere tendency.
And shear, vertical wind shear.
Alex, I've been hogging all the questions. What you got?
We've got one from Kylie Gregory. She says, are the signals of potential increases in intensity one of the reasons behind the new tropical project launching in 2022? To be more specific, I'm referring to the newly planned tropic satellite project involving the University of Wisconsin.
Uh-oh, I'm going to get in trouble now. I'm not involved with that. And so I probably am not an ideal person to speak intelligently about the goals of that particular project. I'm certainly aware of it. But yeah, I think that all of these field experiments and satellite concentrated experiments are all toward better understanding of some of these changes.
All right, we get another question again about the amplification at the Arctic. Could you go in a little bit more into depth on what that means for hurricane formation?
Oh, wow. Well, that's a tough one. I'm not really sure how to answer that. I mean, we're talking mostly about westerlies when we talk about the effect of Arctic amplification. So the mid-latitudes are the regions of the westerlies. You can have a transition from easterly trades in the tropics to mid-latitude westerlies, and then you have the subtropics sort of between it, where, you know, you have variability of the wind direction, the prevailing winds. So I guess I would say that because Arctic amplification would be more, and the discussion that we've been having about how it would affect westerlies and how it would affect the jet and waviness, that's moving away from tropical cyclone formation regions in general. But I suppose you might be able to make an argument that slower winds in general is probably pretty good for formation. I mean, as long as the storm is traveling coherently without a lot of vertical wind shear, it doesn't care too much how quickly it's moving. And if it moves too slowly, it'll tend to cool the waters underneath it and kill itself off. But as you can probably tell, I'm completely spitballing on this. I guess I don't really know, but I think it would be certainly something that would be interesting to look into.
Where is your research going next in this field?
Well, I'm certainly continuing to work on tropical cyclones and the empirical side of things. So I've been called a blue collar scientist because I tend to, and this is maybe from having been exposed to Bill Gray quite a lot back in the 80s, but roll up your sleeves and get your hands dirty kind of thing. And in terms of tropical cyclones and climate change, there's not a whole heck of a lot of empiricists out there. There's a lot of modelers, and of course they're doing fantastic work, but this idea of studying past data in tropical cyclones is a little bit rarefied. And so I'll try to continue to stay in that niche. In my new position, and for me, it seemed like a natural transition. We're taking some of this information that we have, some of these signals that we've uncovered, and translating that to how it affects risk and projections of risk using models, like CMIP-5 models, for example, to give people a better sense of what these changes mean to them or mean to their assets. So this is more kind of where the rubber meets the road that I'm working in now, but it's taking all of these things that we've been doing, not just about tropical cyclones, but all types of extremes, and seeing, you know, basically helping either government organizations or corporations to figure out their climate risk and help them to build resiliency through adaptation. Those are the main things I'm working on now.
Fantastic. Well, this has been a great show. I've really enjoyed it. Look forward to bringing you on board when we have an active storm to get your expert view on what's going on. It's always nice to hear from multiple sources of what we're looking at when we have a significant event. So thanks so much for being with us.
It's been an honor, truly a privilege. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for joining us on Hurricane Center. Produced by the Storm Science Network and made possible by USAA, South Padre Island Convention and Tourist Bureau, and Plylux Hurricane Clips. You can find other episodes on HurricaneCenterLive.com.